I'm Brian Ellison, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Legislative sessions in Missouri and Kansas have hit their halfway points. A yawning budget shortfall in the Show Me State shows no signs of closing, and Kansas City has a mayoral primary just 1 week from today. What better time for a political conversation with reporters covering both states and the city? We'll discuss those storylines and others to help sate your political appetite. And then, where do one person's rights end and another's begin? We'll wade into the issue of religious liberty with a mayor who also is a minister. He says finding the right balance is vital to our country's future. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. If you are one of Kansas or Missouri's elected representatives in Washington, it's a season of answering some tough questions about the Mueller report, about the president's emergency declaration on border security, and let us not forget, it's time to start choosing up sides for a presidential election that's about 20 months away. If that's too soon, well, we could stick to Jeff City or Topeka, where legislatures are wrestling with declining tax dollars, new relationships between governors and legislative leaders, not to mention perennial chestnuts like Medicaid expansion and flood relief and abortion. Or maybe you're hoping to turn to your own neighborhood as a respite from politics. But think again, the primary election in the Kansas City mayoral race, and not to mention that controversial ballot proposal for pre-K sales tax. That's all just 1 week from today. We here at Up to Date are shying away from none of it, and we've assembled an all-star politics panel to equip us for our trip to the water cooler or to the ballot box. Joining me are Eric Wesson, senior staff writer for the Kansas City Call. Eric, good morning.
Good morning, and thanks for having me.
And from 41 Action News, Kat Reed. Hi, Kat.
Hi, happy to be here.
Glad you're back. And from the KCUR newsroom, City Hall reporter and afternoon newscaster, Lisa Rodriguez.
Hi, Brian.
Good to have you here. And we'll bring in even more voices when we move on to state issues. But let's start with Kansas City. Lisa, it's been about 2 years since the first candidates declared they were running for mayor. It seems seems like only yesterday. But now there are 11 of them and the election's a week away. Is it possible to say what this election has come to be about?
Well, if we're talking issues, then the election, I think the issue that's top of mind for most of the city is crime and how we bring that down. And while we've heard, you know, some varying proposals from all the candidates, there are very few hard policy details there. But then again, there's, in the form of government we have here, there's not a whole lot the mayor can do about crime. But you know, after that, I think with the airport project and with the news we heard about the streetcar development and how that happens outside of the downtown corridor is big. But besides issues, I think it's about how many people know who's running and know your name.
Right. I mean, there are things that maybe you can't do anything about them, but you have to talk about them.
Absolutely.
I mean, Eric Wesson, what's standing out to you in this final run toward Election Day?
The inability of the candidates to raise money, I think, is kind of something that's kind of got a flashing light for me, and just how redundant they are. If you go to the forums, you listen to the first candidate, and then you listen to all the other ones after that first candidate, they're all saying the same things. There's nothing that's really separating the candidates. It kind of seemed like they're all doing stump speeches.
Well, I mean, and Kat Reed, that is a real challenge that I know several candidates have mentioned to me. How do you get your name out there above the din, above all the others?
I think it's difficult. I think that you've seen a push, especially in the past few days, of a lot more ads. Initially, we just saw the signs as we drove down. You know, Ward Parkway especially is known for the sign war. They're huge ones. But I'm seeing a lot more ads on social media, particularly Instagram, Facebook. I think that's where a lot of candidates are trying to push ahead. It's very hard at a forum to really make yourself stand out. It's kind of, they say you can only lose a debate, not necessarily win one. And I think that's the case with these forums.
Yeah, these forums, which I understand are happening sometimes multiple nights a week, maybe multiple times a day, Lisa. You moderated one of them last week.
I did. And I asked, I was like, what is this, the 20th forum? And they said it was the 26th. And they had one the next day. And I think last Friday as well. So I think they might be up to 30 forums at this point.
And has anyone, can any of you point to something that you have learned as a journalist or that voters have learned about these candidates from these forums?
Not necessarily. I think the only thing that was interesting that no one had addressed before, I remember a forum in Westport a while back where they were asked if they were pro-choice or not, which not a lot of people have that on their website, believe it or not, for this municipal election.
Right.
But that was the only time.
Rarely comes up in the city council.
Exactly. But that was the only time, and that was such a curveball question. Other than that, I mean, these candidates have their websites. They've had them up with their platforms for a long time. You're not seeing many surprises come out of it.
One of the things that I found interesting and kind of comical was how the candidates shifted to potholes. And potholes are something that, you know, is something really affecting people now, but it's something that we deal with, what, 2, maybe 3 weeks or a month out of a year, and everybody shifted to a plan about potholes when we have so many other relevant issues going on in our community.
You know, I guess I'm curious. I mean, the Kansas City Star has the most recent poll, maybe the only reliable poll in the race, that showed Jolie Justice with a slight lead over this next tier of candidates, Steve Miller, Alicia Kennedy, Jermaine Reed. But frankly, most of those differences were within the margin of error. In this last 7 days of the campaign, what do you think the race will come down to? What will make the difference?
I think mostly it'll come down to who actually shows up to vote in this election.
Absolutely.
But also, I think it's interesting to look at the fundraising. And of course, money doesn't say everything. That doesn't determine the outcome of every election. But if you look at who has the most money left to spend in these next 7 days, this is based off the campaign finance filings that came out yesterday. It looks like the candidates with the most left are Steve Miller, who has about $190,000. Quentin Lucas has $140,000. And Jermaine Reed actually has $106,000 left to spend in these next 7 days.
I'm curious, Lisa Rodriguez, you know, there are 13 votes on the city council, all of which are up for election in this in this election. The mayor just gets one of them. Do any of the city council races stand out to you? Are any of them getting above the fray?
I mean, the city council races, I think, for most part, are getting a little lost behind this super competitive mayor's race. It's been 8 years since we had a competitive mayor's race. But what is particularly interesting to me in the third district, we have both current third district council members, Jermaine Reed and Quentin Lucas, are both running for mayor. So both of those seats are open, and there's a lot of people vying to get to those seats.
Yeah, that at-large race between state representative Brandon Ellington and Reverend Wallace Hartsfield, a very prominent figure. Both of them in the African-American community in Kansas City. That's probably the race to watch, it seems
to me. That's a race to watch. I think the fourth district in district is another one to watch. That is Jolie Justice's seat. And then there's a couple, the fifth district further south has some very cool candidates as well. But those are really the only ones that are competitive at all.
Before we move on, I want to touch base about the pre-K sales tax proposal. We've talked about question one on this program quite a bit. Mayor Sly James is really giving the full court press to this idea. I was moderating a city council candidate forum, so just a neighborhood association gathering last week, and the mayor showed up to stump for the tax. Where does this stand, Eric Wesson?
Well, it looks like it might be a dead heat to the finish line. The last poll I saw was 49% of people that they polled were against it, while 47% were for it, and there was a percentage of undecided. But I think that's going to be interesting, because I think one of the biggest things that they have is governance, with a board that's appointed by the mayor and several other individuals being on there. The governance, who's going to govern the money, the infrastructure that has to be in place, and how much money is going to be spent putting that infrastructure in place. So if you're a parent and you pay for pre-K, you're definitely going to be in support of universal pre-K.
And yet school districts are not in support, Kat.
They are not in support. And the other folks who aren't in support, mostly because of the school districts not being behind this, are pretty much every single mayoral candidate except for Jolie Justice. I don't know, Lisa, correct me if I'm wrong, is everyone who's been on the forum circuit is not supporting this.
Pretty much.
Except Jolie Justice.
Except Jolie Justice, yeah.
And Lisa, before we let you go, why is Mayor James so committed to this issue? What makes this the thing that here in the last few months of his 8 years of service as mayor, he's staking so much on?
Well, I think it's his last big push for something that can truly, you know, change Kansas City for many, many years to come. I think it's fair to say that the airport will be his legacy project. I think although the incoming mayor will have a lot to do with that. That was very much, that's Sly James's kind of signature project. But this is kind of the last push, and really the city doesn't have a whole bunch of sales tax room left to tax the entire city. This would take up part of that as well.
That's KCUR's Lisa Rodriguez. We're going to move on to state topics, and she's going to get back to working on the afternoon newscast. Lisa, thank you so much.
Thanks, anytime.
So as we now shift to state and federal issues from Topeka, we're going to be joined by Jim McLean from the Kansas News Service. Jim, hello.
Hey, good morning, Brian.
Always good to have you here.
Hey, thanks.
And here in the studio, Missouri government and politics reporter KCUR Samuel King. Hi, Samuel.
Hi, Brian.
Good to have you here. So let's start with Kansas. Governor Laura Kelly has issued her first veto. She said no to a bill that cut $500 million in tax breaks for corporations, although it did reduce the food sales tax in the state as well. Jim McLean, how have Republican leaders responded to this first veto from the governor?
Not well, with outrage, Brian. This bill was very important to them, particularly Senate President Susan Weigel. A very complicated bill. Republicans tried to sweeten it a bit in hopes of avoiding a veto by Governor Kelly. Obviously, they were not successful. But you were right. I mean, it does many, many things. It changes the state tax code so that Kansans who are no longer able to itemize because of federal tax changes could go ahead and do so. That's one thing that it does. But the main thing it does is it spares some multinational corporations with operations in Kansas from having to pay taxes on repatriated income. If you remember, part of what Congress tried to do is to get these big companies to bring this money back into the country and then to tax it more lightly in exchange for them returning it, repatriating it. And this bill would have prohibited the state from taxing any of that income. But Governor Kelly has vetoed it because, as you said, over the next 3 years, it would have cost approximately $500 million in revenue that the state now expects to collect.
So I guess one of the things I wonder, Kat Reed, is this a test of not just tax policy, but also of how this newly elected Democratic governor is going to work with or not work with Republican leaders in the legislature?
Well, I know Governor Kelly, obviously bipartisanship was one of her biggest aspects of her campaign. I think that the area that we should be looking at more closely in terms of how she's working with Republicans is the issue of Medicaid expansion.
Let's talk about that. The House last week approved Medicaid expansion in Kansas. That's long been a goal of Democrats. Moderate Republicans teamed up with Democrats to make that happen. Governor Kelly would surely sign it, but first it has to get out of the Senate.
And that's where the challenge is going to be, is getting it out of the Senate, getting it to where people are going to be able to even have a sensible conversation about it. I don't know how that's going to happen because even with everything in place, it's still a red state. So with the red state, it's there. Anti those type of things to take care of their constituents. So it's going to be interesting to see if she can get it out.
Yeah, I mean, Jim McLean, does it look like it has any chance of passing the Senate?
I think it has some chance, Brian. Pretty much everybody you talk to will tell you that if they can get the bill on the Senate floor, there are the votes to pass it. The trick is getting it to the floor. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole here, but there are all kinds of rules that then apply to this.
It takes 24 votes. Right, the math is interesting, yeah.
Right, it does get interesting if you really are interested in this issue because it takes 24 votes to pry it out of a committee over the objections of the leadership. It then takes 27 votes to move it above the line to ensure that it will actually be considered on the Senate calendar. So lots of math here, and then, of course, there is the opportunity to amend the Medicaid expansion bill onto another bill, which is essentially what happened in the House. But Senate leaders are going to be very, very careful then about the bills they allow on the floor to try to prevent that. I mean, the bottom line here is that Senate leadership, President Susan Weigel, Senate Majority Leader Jim Denning, are still very much opposed to expansion, and they're going to do whatever they can to keep it from coming to a vote. So supporters of expansion are going to have to be pretty creative to force that vote.
Meanwhile, Laura Kelly had one of her first real stumbles as governor this month. She found herself compelled to withdraw her nominee to the state's second highest court, the Court of Appeals, Judge Jeffrey Jack, after tweets came to light in which he criticized President Trump and expressed views on issues like abortion rights and gun control. How did this happen, Jim?
Well, I think it happened because of the vetting process wasn't very robust. And I think, frankly, Governor Kelly and others in her administration were caught by surprise when those tweets, as you put it, came to light. They shouldn't have been, but they were. And as soon as they did come to light, I think Governor Kelly, frankly, agreed that they crossed the line from a partisan standpoint. And she quickly withdrew Jeff Jack's nomination for that appellate court judge. Now, the fight over her nominee to head the Kansas Department of Commerce is another matter entirely.
Well, and that certainly is one that's coming up. I mean, part of this is a part of a broader narrative about the place of Democrats and Republicans in Kansas that we are continuing to follow. Democrats were sort of feeling on a bit of a roll in Kansas after the election. Is momentum slowing? Is reality setting in?
I think reality. Oh, sorry, Jim, you go ahead.
No, you go
ahead.
Okay. I think that we knew that there was going to be an uphill battle. I think that there was a lot of excitement when Governor Kelly got into office, but you still have to look at the legislature. I think the thing that is surprising about this vetting process is that Governor Kelly had taken the extra step of, you know, assembling this panel of lawyers and non-lawyers to interview the candidates, to do these interviews publicly and screen them. So I think it's surprising that there was a breakdown in the process there.
If Kansas had been heading in a bluer direction, Missouri, it seemed, was heading in a redder one. Samuel King from KCUR, you've been covering Missouri. You've been down to Jefferson City a couple times now. I'm curious, how successful do you think Republicans who control the House and the Senate and the governor's mansion in Missouri have been in advancing their priorities this session?
We're still just about halfway through the session. The lawmakers came back from spring break yesterday, actually starting their session a little earlier than they normally do on a Monday to look at some things. But I think what sort of the headline is here so far is what hasn't necessarily happened. Mm-hmm. There's only been one bill that's actually made it to Governor Parson's proverbial desk, and decided, and that's renaming a highway for a late representative in the St. Louis area.
But it was signed with much fanfare.
Yes. It was much fanfare, showing, you know, we all can sort of work together on something. But I think there's been some pushback against the governor in a couple of things, and a big one was his plan to borrow $350 million for road and bridge improvements in Missouri after voters rejected the gas tax increase in November. And now the House is debating the budget this week. They're actually doing it as we speak. And the House Budget Chair Cody Smith has proposed his own plan, which the Speaker is backing, wanting to spend $100 million from general fund dollars. And that's something some Democrats are balking at, and the governor is still supporting his initial plan. So we're already seeing some fissures and divides, as it may.
You know, Eric Wesson, we're halfway through the session. It's still hard to know what's coming, as we've heard. But one of the governor's priorities, as Samuel alludes to, was this money for workforce development. This idea that by investing in education programs and training Missouri's workers, we're helping everybody. It sounded like it had initial bipartisan support. Where is that going?
Well, and I kind of want to piggyback the two together, because you were asking about Mayor James and the political capital for the pre-K. He's always been a pro-education mayor. If you think back when he started, it was turn the page. I think one of the things that we're looking at both locally and statewide is your workforce. If you have an educated workforce, then you have companies like Amazon and those type of companies that want to move here because they have a workforce in which to choose from. Cerner is facing the issue that, hey, we're going to have to go outside of Kansas City to find people because of the educational breakdown. So I think the governor gets it. He sees that we have to do something about education for us to be able to draw these companies and corporations and get people trained and get people viable for employment opportunities.
And yet, Kat, all of this is taking place, this debate about how to spend that money and how much of it to spend, against a backdrop of revenues that appear to be declining in the state of Missouri, perhaps the chickens of last year's tax cuts coming home to roost. How do legislative leaders resolve that?
Well, I do think it's interesting. The last analysis I looked at was, I think, March 24th. 1st, and it said revenue was down $340 million. And leaders had expected to make some of that up in income tax collection, but how much is made up kind of remains to be seen. Leaders, Republican leaders, are not backing down on the tax cuts. They are not blaming them for the situation that the state is in right now.
That's not generally how that goes.
Yeah, I mean, and that number continues. We're just looking at some updated numbers. They've actually put some in, and it's still about roughly $350 million. And income tax collections actually down 8%. You know, Republicans are still hoping and thinking that this will turn around this year to avoid any spending cuts. But, you know, the Democrats continue to be skeptical about that. They have been all along. And they say it's not only last year's tax cuts. It's not only the income tax withholding issue. It's the tax cuts from a few years ago as well, sort of kicking in here. So you know, looking at the budget this week, it'll be interesting to see what comes out of Jefferson City this week in the House debate, what we're seeing in terms of revenue pictures and how people plan to adjust. Of course, there's still time for that to turn around, but, you know, the clock is ticking.
You know, over the weekend, let me touch on one other issue in Missouri, and then we'll talk about some federal government issues. We heard Missouri Governor Mike Parson add his voice to those asking some questions about flood control, and specifically about how the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers manages the release of water upstream on the Missouri River. Kat, is that just political opportunism or are those real questions?
It's a debate that's been going on for a very long time. You heard a lot of residents kind of blaming the Army Corps of Engineers. So I think it is a good time for a politician to say, I'm going to take a closer look at that. But this debate is years and years in the making and, you know, has been the subject of a massive lawsuit in federal court that dates back to some changes made to the river in 2004. So this is not new. I think we will continue to see a lot more. And the governor says he plans to sit down with the Army Corps of Engineers and have a little chat.
The debate sort of pit over that policy change in 2004 pits environmental activists versus farmers, essentially.
Right. And when you look at the farmland and how it is just basically destroyed, somebody needs to have some conversations about why this continues to happen, because this isn't the first time. This has happened before. So what are we doing wrong to where this keeps being an issue? So it's a good debate. It's political to a degree, but then it's a environmentally a conversation that they need to have as well.
Samuel King, anything else you're watching for in Missouri in the last 8 weeks of the session or so?
Oh, you know, there's a lot of these hot button issues besides the budget, whether what comes out in terms of abortion restrictions. It looks like there will be some more abortion restrictions and some of the strictest in the country. And on the other side, there seems to be a bipartisan push for criminal justice reform in Jefferson City. You have a wide range of groups supporting them, from, you know, Americans for Prosperity to liberal groups. So something's going to happen with that. And I think the most interesting thing is to me, in terms of, you know, policy wonking and legislative process, is whether this is the year that, you know, this will advance the voters to shrink the House of Representatives and make some changes in Jefferson City. This House Speaker's behind that plan. There seems to be support for it on, you know, for a number of issues. So it'll be interesting to see if voters will actually get to weigh in on that next year.
We shall see. I'll believe it when I see it. before we go, let's talk a little bit about the federal government and the U.S. Congress. You know, the Kansas Senate race in 2020, we kept wondering whether Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, would be a candidate. He seems to have definitively said he will not run to succeed Pat Roberts. Jim McLean, how open is this race?
I think it's still very open, and I think it's still an open question as to whether Pompeo, in the end, will be in that race. He's serving as Secretary of State now. He doesn't want to have to answer a bunch of nagging questions from the president as to whether he's staying around. So I think he's saying what he needs to say to get that issue off the table for him at the moment. But it's going to be a very competitive race. I mean, Pat Roberts has been in the Congress forever and in that U.S. Senate seat for a long time. There's a lot of pent-up desire among up-and-coming Republicans to succeed him. From the aforementioned Susan Weigel, who's the president of the Kansas Senate, you can see a lot of the things that she's doing this legislative session seem to be done with an eye toward that race. State Treasurer Jake LaTourneur has already declared his interest. Some say former Governor Jeff Collier is interested, and Chris Kobach is also waiting in the wings, along with Congressman Roger Marshall out in the 1st District. So it will be a heck of a race.
One of the things that Pat Roberts and his colleagues in the Senate voted on this month was whether to decline or challenge the president's mm-hmm. emergency declaration. On that vote, Roberts voted no. Jerry Moran voted yes. Missouri Senator Josh Hawley voted no, and Roy Blunt voted yes. Mm-hmm. All Republicans splitting their votes on these issues. Let me ask you all, are we seeing anything like an actual divide opening up among Republicans as we approach 2020 elections? Eric Wesson?
Well, I don't think so. I think one of the key issues behind that was giving the president more constitutional power or disregarding the Constitution. And as conservatives, I think their agenda is to preserve the Constitution. So I don't think it was a divide. I think they were doing what they felt was morally correct.
But only some of them, Kat.
That's true. I do think it's interesting to look at the breakdown. And, you know, Blunt very much said that his concern was that Democrats would use the same power to impose policies like gun control and the Green New Deal.
Climate change, right. That's, yeah. Is that a national emergency? Well, and speaking of the Green New Deal, before we walk away from that topic, Sharice Davids held her first town hall since her election in Olathe over the weekend, Congresswoman from Kansas. Any takeaways? One of the things she was asked about was whether she supports the Green New Deal, and she expressed some hesitation. She said she hadn't read it yet.
Some trepidation. She said there are some policies in there that she does not necessarily agree with. So very committal on the Green New Deal, also on the issue of Medicare for All and a single-payer option for health care. She said she hasn't read the full Medicare for All bill, the most recent that was proposed, and she wasn't willing to commit to that.
Jim McLean, Congresswoman Davids, got a lot of attention on her election. Mm-hmm. This was her first town hall, something that her predecessor, Kevin Yoder, was criticized for not having more of those town halls. Mm-hmm. How does it appear she did?
Well, I think what it appears to me is she's being very cautious, which I think is appropriate at this point, having won that election and having swung the district from a Republican to Democrat, and she doesn't want to be lumped in with the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez wing of the party just yet, and yet she also doesn't want to disappoint the progressive voters who put her in that seat. So it seems to me that she's being appropriately cautious at this point, but at some point she's going to have to start taking sides in some of these debates that are going to be front and center in the presidential campaign.
I wish we had more time, but we're going to have to leave it there. That's Jim McLean of the Kansas News Service. We've also been joined by Samuel King of KCUR, Eric Wesson of the Kansas City Call, and Kat Reed of 41 Action News. Thank you all for being part of the panel today.
Thank you, Brian.
Thanks for having me.
Still ahead, a man who is both a minister and a mayor gives us his take on the meaning of religious liberty. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. And welcome back to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Brian Ellison in for Steve Kraske. Monday on the program, flooding has devastated the region. We talked with farmers about their losses, and the Army Corps of Engineers explained what contributed to those. You can hear that at kcur.org/up-to-date. Join us tomorrow. The president declared a national emergency to fund the border wall, but former U.S. Ambassador Thomas Pickering disagrees with that decision. We'll ask him why. That's tomorrow on the program. Today we're talking about religious liberty, and principles of religious liberty have been part of American identity since before the founding. Thomas Jefferson's classic language about a wall separating church and state is as familiar as life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But many would say that ideas about the connection between freedom and religion and freedom of religion have evolved over our country's history, and some are troubled by the direction of that conversation in recent years. Reverend Dr. Aidsand Wright Riggins is mayor of Collegeville, Pennsylvania. He's also the former CEO of the American Baptist Home Mission Societies and also was a pastor in California for 20 years. He's delivering the annual Sheridan Lectures on Religious Liberty and Separation of Church and State. Those are happening tonight at William Jewell College in Liberty and tomorrow at Central Baptist Theological Seminary in Shawnee. And he joins us in our studios this morning. Mayor Wright Riggins, welcome.
Thank you, Brian. It's wonderful to be here.
It's so good to have you. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. It's the first words of the First Amendment. It's not that many words. Why is it such a complicated issue?
Well, I think that those first 16 words are incredibly important. First of all, it allows us to protect individuals and their own particular religious liberties, as well as having an opportunity to make sure that others are not infringing on the rights of others. That's become incredibly more complicated and contentious as we see the development of groups in this country that want to both protect, overprotect particular religious rights, as well as advance their religious perspectives over the rights of others.
Before we get to those complicated questions of our own day, help us with a little bit of a primer based on how this came to be in the Constitution. When the Constitution prohibits laws establishing a religion, what did that mean?
Well, I think in coming to this country, we had a number of people who felt like they were under persecution because of their own particular religious beliefs. But then as they came to this country, there was a question as to whether or not this religion would be a dominant religion, whether it'd be an established religion, or whether it would take a kind of more of a hegemonic response or approach to it, in which it was saying that nobody else could have those own particular religions. And so that I think that our country wisely understood that a democracy really needed a diverse population in which people were free to be religious, non-religious, and being able to be free from having their beliefs cordoned off or pushed to the side.
So at the same time that the Constitution said that the government couldn't establish a religion, it
right.
also protected the free exercise of that
exactly.
religion by anybody. But of course, people can't just do anything they want and call it religious, right?
Well, absolutely, they could not. But increasingly, we're seeing in this country, however, that there are groups that are beginning to say that I want to decide that I won't serve you. I won't recognize you because of my own particular religious beliefs. And it seems to me that we're beginning to move to a place where we have so individualized freedom of conscience and then labeling it religious freedom, or we have taken our biases and prejudices and religified that in such a way that we're saying that we are protected to discriminate against other people.
Well, we're going to talk more about that. I want to invite our listeners to the conversation, too. Though, do you feel like the meaning of religious liberty has changed in this country? What does it mean to you? We'd like your thoughts on this issue and also your questions for our guest today, Dr. Edsand Wright-Riggins. Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. You can also tweet at us. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Let's take a step back. How did you come to be involved with this issue? You were a pastor, and how did you come to start thinking about these constitutional issues?
Well, it's really interesting. I would not say that I was a native to this conversation. I think I got into this conversation largely because of my perspectives on issues of race. Being in this country, by the way, this happens to be the 400th year of the commemoration of the first slaves who came to this country. Mm-hmm. And our country has been wrestling with, I think, the whole issue of racial liberty for over 500 years, really. And then after that, the whole issue of religious liberty. And as I've come to see how important it is for me to be able to live in a situation where I am free to live my life and experience justice, I've also come to see that religious liberty is very similar to the issue of racial justice. And so, in the words of Martin Luther King, a threat to one person's liberty is a threat to other person's liberty. We're all clothed in the same garment of mutuality. And so, as I have seen how issues of racialism and racial injustice have impacted me, I also began to see, as a religious leader, how that was beginning to impact other minorities in this country. And so I chose to identify and be in solidarity with them on these issues.
So you were involved and you did some of this work at your denominational level as an American Baptist. You worked with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference.
Correct.
But you also, at some point, decided you would run for mayor of your town. How did that come to happen?
That was an interesting thing. I retired from the American Baptist Churches USA 3 years ago. I was recruited by members of my community to run for office. So the choice was between becoming a council person or mayor. When I decided to run, it really wasn't with the aim of winning an election as much as having an opportunity to use that year to be able to have an alternative voice to some of the vitriol that I experienced and my community experienced in the elections of 2016. I saw a lot of the same kind of division and hatred and division in my own particular local community as I saw at the national level. Mm. And for me, winning meant being able to have that pulpit of campaigning throughout that year to be able to make a difference. Collegeville, where I happen to serve, is over 90% Euro-American. It is predominantly Christian. It had not had a Democratic mayor ever in its 100-year history, and it certainly had not had an African-American. But it gave me an opportunity to speak to issues that were important to me and be able to speak to populations to say, I am with you and we are with you during that. So I ran, had a powerful message, and we won that election.
How was your faith and your identity as a minister and as a person who speaks publicly about their faith connected with your decision to campaign for office and become a public servant?
For me, it's really important that I have a voice in the public square. Whether that is a person of faith or a person in terms of coming out of my own African-American perspective or a political perspective. I ran not to Christianize my community, but rather to have an opportunity to, on the basis of my faith, project values of civility and character in that community. Interesting, I was just saying to students at William Jewell a little earlier today that I kind of have a couple of identities. In one identity, I'm Mayor Wright Riggins. In another identity, I'm Reverend Dr. Wright Riggins. A few weeks ago, I happened to have gone to a religious affair, the ordination commissioning of a woman to a role. I don't usually wear a collar, but I wore a clergy collar to that event. But as my wife and I were making our way back to Collegeville, stopped to have some dinner and a drink, she reminded me that I needed to take off my collar as I came back into Collegeville, because in Collegeville, I am Mayor Wright Riggins, not the Reverend Dr. Mayor Wright Riggins. And so I make a separation around those issues, but I'm certainly inspired by my need to be a public voice, particularly sharing particular values and vision for the community.
Well, I think that's the thing that seems so complicated, right? Where you draw the line. You speak of running for office so that you can project your values into the community. And I've read of where you wrote about your sense of running for election as a calling, as mm-hmm. an extension of
yes.
your ministry. Where is the line between that and someone who, in your view, would be transgressing that wall between church and state? What would you have to do to be going too far?
I think going too far is to be being sectarian and being projecting a kind of a proselytizing a role in that. I think that there are some common values that are essential to community. A civility, a character, a kindness, a tolerance, and I think that those span the whole globe of religions and non-religious people, just people of good ethics and ways of living. So, to me, while my motivation, a lot of my motivation comes because of my faith, the last thing in the world that I think I or anybody else needs to do is to project and to call for the embracing of my particular faith perspective in the public space.
I've heard one of our senators from Missouri, Senator Josh Hawley, who was our attorney general and is now a U.S. senator, speak to groups about this same topic. And he has also talked about how his faith compelled him to enter the political arena. And for him, he speaks of how that influences the policy positions he takes and the things that he works for, which in his case includes limiting abortion rights. It includes reinforcing quote-unquote traditional values around marriage and so on. How is that different from what you are saying happens in your own commitment to public service?
Well, I think that's an interesting piece to me. That for me, it is not so much the advancing of a particular policy matter that comes out of my faith itself as opposed to advancing a public policy matter that comes in terms of the common good. So for me, what I call the great criteria when I think about Matthew 25 and Jesus said, as often as you've done this to the least of these, you've done it to me. So to me, the best perspective on a society is how do we address those who are minorities, who are marginalized, who are voiceless, who are being ignored in the public square. And sometimes those people I can vehemently disagree with in terms of their own particular perspectives, but because I want to recognize their humanity and their rights, I have to fight for them in the midst of that. I can be a person who has particular perspectives or positions on some of these issues, but realizing that, wow, this perspective and this perspective on the issue for me is probably more religiously motivated than it is motivated from the perspective that we're all citizens of this country where democracy rules and not theocracy. And so for me, it's really, really important to set aside what my own particular faith perspective is on something and to begin to think about what does my faith move me to do and be engaged in with regards to the common good.
So there are a number of religious liberty cases moving their way through courts right now that may end up before the U.S. Supreme Court at some point. There's one in Washington State right now where a florist refused to provide flowers for a same-sex wedding. And there, on the one side, the florist cites religious freedom that they say gives them the right not to provide the flowers because the marriage conflicts with their religious beliefs. And you've got the other side, the couple, citing religious freedom that they say protects them from discrimination on the basis of someone else's religious views. So how can the same words mean opposite things?
Well, that perspective to me sounds, and I'm not a legal scholar on this, but that perspective sounds far too similar to me to what some white racist nationalist could have said in the 1950s to say that my religious beliefs looks at an African American as less than a person or not fully human, so therefore I have the religious right and ability to discriminate against them by serving them lunch at a drugstore food counter. So I think that in a similar way, we have moved to the place in which we are saying that your rights end when I am offended by who you are as a person or some of the choices you make. And I think that that is only a license to discriminate against persons as opposed to really being a case of religious liberty.
Again, our guest is Dr. Adsand Wright-Riggins. If you have questions for him or want to join the conversation, give us a call at 816-235-2888. You're speaking tonight at William Jewell College in Liberty. The title of that lecture is Right-Sizing Religious Liberty. What does that mean? What does religious liberty need to get bigger or smaller?
The point that I'm making with the title Right-Sizing Religious Liberty, in fact, it didn't quite start in that direction, but the point that I'm making with regards to saying right-sizing religious liberty, I'm basically saying that in this country, the right has hijacked the issue of religious liberty, and they are right-sizing it, that they're only looking at religious liberty through the lens of a right-wing perspective on religion, as opposed to the broad nature in which religious liberty in this country was first initialized and thought of.
But do you see any merit to the view that many do express on the right that conservative Christian beliefs have been at times marginalized or excluded, or that are not provided the same access to certain public policy avenues?
I don't believe that they've been marginalized. I really think that what is happening in this country is we are seeing more pluralism with regards to religions. We're seeing much more cultural diversity. And I think as a result of that, we're also seeing conservatives, we're seeing those who have been historically privileged feeling quite uncomfortable in terms of a change in the national ethos or demographics in terms of wow, I've never seen it this way before. And so rather than learning how to live with it and learn how to bridge that divide and embrace change, what I think we're really saying is a kickback, a fallback with regards to how people are fighting against change as opposed to fighting for their own particular rights.
Yeah, I should mention the other lecture you're giving, the one tomorrow, is titled Race, Resistance, Religion, and Rage, which leads me to wonder what is the correct way for religion to exert influence on politics?
Well, I think again, the influence really comes in terms of being motivated by one's particular faith perspective or lack thereof, and being engaged in the public square. Race and religion and resistance, from an African American perspective, have oftentimes been a mixed piece in which all of those have moved together. But my religion motivates me. Equips me, gives me the hope, gives me the sustenance to be able to stay strong in the battle, in the fight, to be able to move a racial justice agenda forward. But it does not push it to be pushed forward such that it becomes another case of racial superiority on the other side of the other fence.
Let's take a quick question from Pomona calling from Kansas City. Hello, thanks for calling.
Hi. Yes, my concern, I think your guest has very good intentions, what he's saying, and I agree with a lot of what he's saying. But my concern when I hear this is that, I don't see it really very clear cut between someone's religious values and then what they would bring to the table as a politician or a leader in the community. What I find as someone who's not a Christian is... I find that there's this assumption of these shared values that I don't think really exist across all religions. And so to assume that, the frustration I have is that a lot of Christians think that if someone says they're a Christian, that they have good values. But if you're on the outside of that religion, sometimes those values seem highly immoral.
Okay, so I appreciate the question, Pomona. I'm sorry I have to cut you off. We're almost out of time. But there is a diversity of religious views.
Absolutely. I know some horrible Christians, and I have some Christians whose values that I certainly disagree with. So I'm not saying that I went into office to promote my Christian value, but I am saying that a value of community service and respecting, from my perspective, and respecting my fellow human being is what motivated me. But I would never take at face value that someone is worthy of being in a particular office because he or she was a Christian or was a Muslim or was a Hindu or was a Buddhist. I don't think that doesn't mean anything.
It neither qualifies them nor disqualifies
exactly.
them. Exactly. Well, I wish we had more time to talk more about these lectures, but you can go to them. The one will be tonight at William Jewell College in Liberty and the other will be tomorrow at Central Baptist Theological Seminary in Shawnee. These are the Sheridan Lectures on Religious Liberty and the Separation of Church and State. And the Reverend Dr. Aidsand Wright Riggins is mayor of Collegeville, Pennsylvania, and he'll be delivering those. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes with
us
today.
Appreciate it.
Appreciate having you. Yesterday, we talked about the story of the last executions at Fort Leavenworth, which was also a story of race. On yesterday's program, we learned why, and you can hear that and other previous episodes at kcur.org/uptodate. Find and follow us on Twitter. We're at @KCURUpToDate. I'm at @PTSBrian. And don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow, has anything concrete really been done to provide safety since the 9/11 attacks? We'll ask former U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security Janet Napolitano that very question. Join us tomorrow at 11. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date.